I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Baltimore is reeling from a deadly, violent year. 344 homicides, plus nearly twice that many non-fatal shootings. Across the city, in emergency rooms, clinics, schools, and nonprofits, these crimes are straining resources, and nowhere more severely than among police investigators. In September, the Baltimore Sun was given exclusive access to the Baltimore Police Department's homicide unit as it investigated the fatal shooting of a 29-year-old man. In the resulting five-part investigative series, Chasing a Killer, reporter Justin Fenton details the painstaking pursuit of leads and the struggle by police to regain the community's trust. Homicide, gun violence, and resources to prevent them. That's Midday, after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm so glad you are with us. We're 6 days into the new year, and one piece of bittersweet news is that Baltimore City has only seen one homicide so far in 2016. It might be naive to assume the city will be able to keep this slow pace. At this rate, about one murder per week, Baltimore would see under 60 murders this year. A far cry from bloody 2015. Last year, the city counted almost one homicide a day, 344 in total. When non-fatal shootings are taken into account, there were more than 900 shooting victims in the city last year. On a per capita basis, it was the deadliest year in Baltimore's history. With so many victims, resources in the city have been spread thin. Emergency rooms at Baltimore's three designated trauma hospitals, which each care for 6,000 to 8,000 patients a month, treated close to two shooting victims a day. Later this hour, we'll speak with Samuel Beeler, a research associate in the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, about how fewer resources could be spent responding to gun violence by putting more resources into preventing it. Perhaps no entity felt the strain of resources as much as the homicide unit of Baltimore's police department. That unit comprises eight squads and 50 detectives, some of whom carry the role of primary detective in 10 or more murder cases at a time. In September, the Baltimore Sun was given exclusive access to the Baltimore Police Department's homicide unit as it investigated the killing of a 29-year-old man, Kevin Kennedy, in Northwest Baltimore. The reporting resulted in the five-part investigative series called Chasing a Killer. In the series, reporter Justin Fenton details the painstaking process of uncovering and chasing leads in a homicide investigation and the struggle by police to regain the trust of the community, especially of people with information that might help solve a crime. And Justin Fenton is our guest this hour. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you for having me.
Justin, before we start talking about your terrific series, let's pick up on the reporting you've been doing today. You, like WIPR's own P. Kenneth Burns, were in the courtroom for pretrial motions in the second of the six trials of the officers involved in the death of Freddie Gray. This time, it's Officer Caesar Goodson, the driver of the transport van. The most serious charge against Goodson is second-degree depraved heart murder. Tell us about the pretrial motions this morning.
The motions this morning were brief. They were consistent with the judge's rulings in the first case. He's not going to change the venue. He said he, quote, still has faith in the system. He also said the jurors won't be sequestered and that they'll be able to do things such as look at the transport van that Freddie Gray was injured inside of. The big drama for the day is the afternoon session when we will hear whether Officer Porter, who was the first to go on trial, will be compelled to testify. He says he does not want to testify. He's invoking his constitutional protections against that. The state has offered him immunity, and the judge is going to make the decision as to whether he has to go forward and participate in that trial.
The state is offering immunity.
The state has offered it, yes.
And so we'll hear about and is it likely that the judge will make a decision on that today?
We believe so. I mean, Officer Goodson's trial is scheduled to begin Monday. All the parties are going to be in the courtroom this afternoon at 2, and we should know before the end of the day.
Well, thank you for that update on the trial. Let's focus on your series, Chasing a Killer. How did you focus on this particular murder, the shooting of 29-year-old Kevin Kennedy on September 21st? Was that your choice or the was that a negotiation between you and the police department? How did it come about?
Well, for 2 years I had been lobbying the police department to allow this access. They really hadn't since David Simon's homicide book from the late 80s. And, you know, we had written about – we always write stories about the victims of homicides. And in August we wrote a big story that where we profiled 45 victims' families and wrote about them. But, you know, there's always been this issue of sort of why don't cases get solved? What are police doing to solve them? The clearance rate, it's well known, has dropped below 50%. Less than 50% of cases are closed by arrest. And so we really wanted to show the readers, I wanted to know sort of what is happening behind the scenes? Why are things the way they are? And so the department, with the new commissioner, Kevin Davis, he came from PG County. He had allowed a reporter.
Came from Prince George's by way of Anne Arundel.
Correct. And he took over in July when Commissioner Batts was asked to step down. In PG County, he allowed a reporter to do a year-long embed with the homicide unit there for a book that's going to be coming out soon. And so he was very open to this idea, and they actually granted access with no strings attached. So it was basically once they agreed to do it, the next case that came out was the one I was going to be assigned to. And the first one that came up was a murder-suicide, and I said, well, there's no one to arrest or pursue, and I declined. And so just hours later, a shooting came out. It was still daylight, and it came out in northwest Baltimore, and I went up there and met the detectives for the first time.
So you met them at the same moment they were taking over this case.
I actually got there before them, and there was a sort of a bit of a dance as we tried to figure out, you know, what was I going to be able to see? How was this going to work? But I really was just a fly on the wall as the detectives went through their process. And, you know, in many ways, this was a typical case, unfortunately. It was a young black male shot in broad daylight. There was lots of people out, but there was no witnesses. They had it on camera. It was drug-related, believed to be. But in other ways, there was some extraordinary details behind the case. I mean, as I detail in the first part, one of the lead detectives knew the family. He had grown up with the victim's older brother. And this was actually the third of three brothers to be killed on the streets of Baltimore.
A heart-stopping circumstance. I mean, that if any reader of your was debating whether or not to get sucked into a five-part series, that element, the idea of three sons being lost to gun violence, is just stunning.
Yeah, and that fact was not known when we sort of decided this was going to be the case. So, you know, the second brother had been killed by police, actually, so the family did not have good feelings about police. And so they allowed
you
me
say
to
at
be...
At two points during the series, you sort of summarize a deterioration of the family's attitude toward police, that they were disappointed when the eldest son, the one whom Detective Jackson knew, they were disappointed that his case was not solved.
Mm-hmm.
But then when their second son was shot by police say he was driving a car toward two police officers with badges showing, then it went beyond disappointment to actual anger at the police department.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the first case, police had leads. They said, we're going to solve this case. And the family said that they never really heard from anyone else again. And that's really something that you hear from time to time or time and time again from victims' families who say that, you know, we sort of stopped hearing things about what was going on. And so that was another thing I wanted to get to see with this. This investigation was sort of, you know, how would they manage their caseload, manage other cases that were coming in? Because they don't get to focus on one case. You know, they have this case for a couple days, and then it can just be a few days before something else comes up, and they have to drop everything and run out. And so they're sort of always building on these caseloads, and, you know, and frankly, you know, things do get pushed down the list of priorities. It's inevitable.
And the another thing that I picked up, but you obviously can tell me if I got it right, is unlike some of the cop shows we see on TV, these two detectives, refresh my memory on their names, by the way.
Detective Damon Talley and Detective Thomas Jackson.
And they don't always work as a team, right?
No, they work in a squad concept. So they have the unit is divided up into eight squads that have about six detectives each, and they rotate. They rotate based on the shifts that they're working. Some units can get slammed and pick up, you know, like a dozen cases in a week, and they rotate among who picks up the responsibility, and they sort of get each other's backs. So Detective Talley was the primary in this case, and Detective Jackson went out with him. They always try to go two at a time with a sergeant. But as I saw, as I spent time with them, that doesn't even always happen. There was cases that would come out in the middle of the night, and someone would say, I'm going to go, and everyone else said, I'm not able to, and he would just go. So they're really, it's a definite state of triage over there. One detective had 12 cases last year. That is crazy. The recommended limit for the amount any detective across the country should have in a year is like 4 to 6, and that's based on whether they're able to close cases very quickly and they're free to pick something else up. But 12 is sort of unheard of, and as you would imagine, many of those cases are unsolved.
So they work on a squad basis, and am I right that they work citywide?
They do, yes.
Because you write about another detective who is more rooted in that particular neighborhood in Northwest Baltimore. Tell us about how that works.
Well, there was, when the cases come in, they definitely do work together. When we got back from the crime scene, people were stopping by Detective Talley's desk and saying, I've heard of this guy, or I worked a case where he was a suspect, in terms of other, witnesses and associates and people of interest. And so, the department has amassed a lot of information. They have a lot of databases they can plug into. But at the end of the day, they need witnesses. They need people who will come to court. And there's a lot of stuff they knew about this case or believe that they know, but they need people to sort of to stand behind that, because it's not enough to sort of have whispers on the street and things that you typed into a computer. They've got to have people. And that is a huge, huge challenge to closing these cases.
You open this series describing the crime scene this way, quote, Kennedy's body, Kevin Kennedy, the deceased, Kennedy's body was gone. So too was anyone who might have witnessed his broad daylight execution. As a light rain fell, the only people who approached the crime scene tape were pedestrians trying to pass through. They seemed irritated at the inconvenience, close quote. Is that the gist you got from people in the neighborhood, that a homicide has become an inconvenience rather than a community-altering event?
Absolutely. I mean, this was a main thoroughfare, and cars were driving up and turning around. We knew from the case being the killing being captured on video that there was a lot of people who were outside when it happened, but no one had stuck around to assist the detectives. There was people on their front steps down the street, sort of watching from afar, and there was people who would approach trying to get through. There was no tips waiting for police when they got back. Veterans of the unit have told me that they say that in the 90s and before, they could routinely come back to the office and there was sort of a fistful of tips written on slips of paper from people who had called in, and these tips were awaiting them to go chase down, and that doesn't happen anymore. And that's a real frustration of the detectives, because they understand that there's a distrust from the community. They understand there's a fear of cooperating. They don't discredit that. And yet they're in the position of they can't solve that problem. They need people to talk so they can solve this case, so they can put someone in jail for this family. And as you saw in the story, there's a very limited number of people that they were able to question, people with varying degrees of involvement in the case who had lots of reasons not to want to cooperate. And what they're missing are sort of the uninvolved folks who may have seen something.
So walk us through actually a couple of things. Tell us about Detective Jackson's I don't want to say contact exactly, because as you said, Detective Talley was the primary detective, and when they first met the family, Detective Talley, I think, sort of led the conversation. But tell us about Detective Jackson's connection or conversation with the mother of Kevin Kennedy.
Yeah, I sort of picked up that Detective Jackson had a connection to this case right at the very beginning. When the name of the victim was read to him, he closed his eyes and he tilted his head back, and I saw that, and I said, why, what elicited that reaction from him?
You said to yourself.
Yeah, I said it to myself, and I asked him later, much later, sort of what's going on here, why did you do that? And he had grown up with Kevin Kennedy's oldest brother, Anthony Kennedy. Detective Jackson is from the city. He grew up in Park Heights. He went to school with Anthony Kennedy. They worked at a McDonald's together. They would go roller skating on Saturday nights. At a certain point, Detective Jackson was working janitorial jobs, and he wanted something different for himself. And he applied to every job he could think of, basically. And he said the police department was the first one that responded. And so he took it, and he pursued a career in law enforcement. He'd never been in trouble. He played sports. His parents kept him out of that, out of the streets. Anthony Kennedy went a different way. He got involved in drug dealing. His father had a drug problem and would die of an overdose years later. Things really started to compound for him in 1998. He was arrested in a big raid with $20,000 worth of crack cocaine and guns. He was back out on the streets when he and two other people were bound and killed from shotgun blasts. And so Detective Jackson at that time was a young police officer. He attended the funeral. He would also attend the funeral for the second brother when he was killed by police in 2009. So, you know, he was afraid that his connection to the family, that people would question that, that they would say he was biased or he should recuse himself. And he was at times both very wary of really...
hold that thought. Yeah. I want to understand a bit why anyone might think that his friendship with some of the family would be a conflict of interest in investigating how to get justice for them.
I think they all see themselves as dispassionate investigators, that they don't have a stake in it, that they want to solve the case, they want to get justice for the families. And so the idea that he knew that this family, you know, someone could cast aspersions on that. And so he was very clear that he's not the primary detective, although he did take a primary role in questioning all the suspects and witnesses. I think that's his personality. But I asked him at the end, I said, you know, how satisfying will it be to, if you're able to give the good news to the victim's mother, how satisfying will that be? And he said, it's just another case, and I'm not the primary detective. I'm actually going to let Damon Talley do that. But it goes to show you that I think that there are, you know, a lot of police officers live outside the city. I think it's something like 70% of the officers don't live in the city. A lot of them aren't from here, and there's a lot of criticism that the force needs to look more like the community that it works in, you know, and these detectives are from Baltimore. Detective Jackson's from Park Heights, as I said. Detective Talley's from the East Side. Again, that wasn't a plan of the police department. You know, these guys were just next up when I was assigned the story, but I think it shows that there are officers from here who continue to work here and care about this community.
And you were when I interrupted you, you were about to tell us about what Detective Jackson said to Diane
Frederick, yes.
Frederick, mm-hmm. Kevin Kennedy's mother.
Well, he basically, I mean, the family will often hear things that the detectives won't. People will stop by the house and they'll say that they heard certain things. So they try to establish a connection with them. I think that in that moment, you know, he wanted them to know that he was on the case. You know, it wasn't just some random officers. I'm here, but you know, Detective Talley is going to be your point person, and you need to trust him, and please pass anything along that you might hear about this case.
Justin Fenton, we're going to take a break in a minute, but before we do, I want to get back to a phrase you used a few minutes ago, fly on the wall, in terms of your function as a reporter, as an observer of this homicide investigation. You are not a fly. You are a kind of a tall guy with a beard. I mean, how did you melt into the background so that you weren't actually changing the way the investigation unfolded? And were there times when they said you just can't be here? Were there times when you thought I can't be here?
Well, astute readers will note that I took all the pictures for the series.
I did notice that.
So I mean, I didn't want it to have this feel that there was a, you know, documentary camera crew around. I wanted them to feel comfortable with me being there.
I think the detectives to feel comfortable.
Correct. Well, comfortable to the extent that they wouldn't change what I was able to see. And really, I think as much as I heard from the previous administration that the unit absolutely did not want anybody watching what they did, would not want someone in there documenting things, that I was received very well and was not held away from anything. As you can see, I was able to witness their interviews with the suspects, which I think is very unusual.
Were you behind a window doing that?
They started recording the interviews about 2 years ago. That's a new thing. What they used to do was they would interview people for a long time. Then they would get out a tape recorder and say, okay, now do it on tape. And then they would tape record it. And every single court case, the defense attorney would say, why weren't they recording the whole thing? And what else was going on in that room? And so a few years ago, they installed video cameras that record everything from start to finish. So when the detectives bring someone into an interview room, they go to their computer, their desktop computer in the office, hit play, go in the room, and everything is recorded. And I was sitting at their desks watching that feed as it was coming in. So I wasn't in the room, but I was able to watch from a feed.
Lots more questions for Justin Fenton, the reporter who wrote a five-part investigative series titled Chasing a Killer, who had access from the Baltimore Police Department to its homicide unit as they investigated the murder of Kevin Kennedy. He was murdered on September 21st. We've got, when we come back, we'll get a feel for exactly how many resources are being put toward responding to gun violence. We will be talking also with Sam Beeler of the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. And you can be part of this conversation, too. You can phone us at 410-662-8780 if you have a question or comment about Justin Fenton's series. Long distance, our number is 866-661-9309, or you can email us at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a bit. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here with the Baltimore Sun's Justin Fenton. We're talking about his five-part investigative series, Chasing a Killer, in which he was given access by the Baltimore Police Department's homicide unit to be a fly on the wall as they investigated the killing of Kevin Kennedy, a 29-year-old Baltimore resident, on September 21st. If you read the series and had some questions about what it either what you've read in it or what you felt you didn't understand from it, this is a great time to call Justin Fenton. You can call us locally at 410-662-8780. Our long distance number is 866-661-9309. And our email address is midday@wypr.org. We'd love to know what you think about both this particular series and what it showed us about the resources that the Baltimore Police Department has to put into investigating these homicides that have so bedeviled the city in the past year. So, Justin, I'm going to ask you to go. It's a five-part series, and I'm going to ask you to give us an encapsulation, if you can.
Spoilers.
Of how, yeah, spoiler alert. But folks have to read this series. It really tells us a lot. They tell us kind of how the investigation unfolded. That first day, those first few hours, they really felt they were in a pretty good place compared to a lot of other investigations, in that they had, as you mentioned, video. There were like at least two video cameras that caught the shooting or part of it. They seemed pretty optimistic that first night.
Yeah, I mean, again, one of the things I was hoping to glean from this experience was, you know, I always go to the crime scenes and stand on the other side of the tape, and you sort of look at people standing around and say, what are all those people doing? And then it looks like they're just standing there doing nothing. And in fact, there was a lot that was going on. And in the first couple hours of the investigation, again, as a layperson, I felt like this case would be solved that night, based on things you see on TV and whatnot. Though there were no witnesses, an anonymous tipster had called 911 and said, I saw the gunman hide the gun behind a home. And so a considerable amount of time was spent searching that property. It was a vacant home, overgrown brush. They spent a considerable amount of time searching that property, and they did find a gun. They have matched that gun to the crime scene, they believe. They did have the killing on tape from two different businesses. This happened in a commercial area. There was two carryouts, and there was a car dealership that captured it, various aspects of it on tape. And then there was the detectives who work in the district. So there's the homicide unit that is centralized and citywide that investigates homicides and unattended deaths. Then there are the district detectives who are based in the police districts who investigate non-fatal shootings, robberies, and other serious types of crimes. And there was a detective from the Northwest District named Joe Brown who knew the area very well. He's worked his entire career there. And he had been in the area just before the shooting. He had seen some guys hanging out on the corner that he recognized.
By the way, we should say what street. You mentioned this is the main thoroughfare, but I didn't ask you what street it actually happened on.
It was Reisterstown Road and Cordelia Avenue. And so it's in the Langston Hughes neighborhood.
Okay.
And Detective Brown instantly recognized people on the footage as people that he had known from previous investigations. There was one that is sort of ominously referred to throughout the story as the Golden Child.
Yeah, tell us about the Golden Child.
He's a suspect that they believe to be involved in all types of crime in the area, various shootings, and they're never able to pin it on him. Or when they do charge him with a crime, I guess the word would be eludes justice, not knowing the evidence. Their opinion is that he gets away with it each time. And so this so-called Golden Child, whose name we didn't use because he has not been charged in this case, was someone who was a very key person for them. But, I'm standing there. First time inside a case like this, and I thought, boy, if you know who the guys are, go get them. And it doesn't work that way. They sort of take a step back, they hit the reset button, and they start trying to find people on the edges. They want to get other witnesses who can perhaps tie those guys to the scene so that when they do sit down with them, they can come at them with more information from a better standpoint. And so what happens then is this case where we have the gun, we have the killing on tape, and they think they know who did it. The city. they believe they have all these things in place, and yet by the time the story ran, no one had been charged in the case. There was this painstaking process of finding people. Even when they knew who they wanted to find, they could not find them. The suspected shooter completely went underground. The units on the street said he hadn't been seen. They called his probation agent, and he said he hadn't been checking in, which would be fortuitous because it would allow them to, once found, arrest him on a violation of his probation and question him. But nevertheless, that process took months. And one of the things that the detectives, everybody wanted to say to me very quickly when I got to the homicide unit was that we think we know who did it in about 75% of the cases. We believe we know the suspects, but we don't have the evidence to charge. And so that's kind of where the case sits at now. These detectives feel that they have a solid case. They feel that they know who did it. They have not been given the approval by the state attorney's office to pursue charges, and that is a part of this checks and balances of the system, and it's something that they lament, but it's the circumstance nonetheless.
Let me pull somebody else into this conversation with Justin Fenton, Baltimore Sun reporter, whose five-part investigative series is called Chasing a Killer. Let me now turn to Sam Beeler. He's a research associate in the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, where he works on issues of gun violence, crime mapping, and social impact innovation. He co-wrote a new report titled Policing 2016, To Deliver Safety, Police Need Legitimacy and Accountability. Welcome to Midday, Sam Beeler.
Nice to see you.
I'm glad you could join us. So, give us the thumbnail summary of this report you've done about whether there's a trade-off between accountability that police owe the community and legitimacy that would generate trust in the community.
So one of the things that we really saw going into the end of 2015 was this debate around the quote-unquote Ferguson effect, the idea that if police were subject to more accountability, they might pull back from their duties, they might otherwise kind of fall back from their responsibilities, and that would increase crime. In effect, it posited this trade-off. You can either have accountability and legitimacy in the eyes of the community, or you can have increased public safety. And our core argument is that you actually need both accountability and legitimacy in the community if you're going to deliver safety. You need to have a community where people believe that the police are someone who can be trusted, someone whose authority is to be respected, someone who should be looked to for compliance. And when you have accountability and legitimacy, research finds that you actually have people who are more likely to respond to police commands, people who are more likely to collaborate with the police. So you actually don't have this trade-off between safety and legitimacy. You really very much need legitimacy and accountability if the police are to be effective in delivering public security and safety.
But how do you make it happen? Because certainly Baltimore is not the only city which has where some people have seen it as a trade-off, not a both-and, but an either-or.
Great question. What you need to do is you really need to begin providing the kind of training for police officers on how to ensure that their interactions with the public are ones that promote accountability and promote legitimacy. You've seen this in the Chicago Police Department, where they actually developed, in coordination with Yale, a training curriculum giving officers some of the tools they would need to begin to increase that legitimacy, because every interaction between the police and the community is an opportunity to either increase that relationship and build legitimacy or to inflict damage on it. And there are really important tools and training, giving people more of a say in interactions, making people feel like their opinion is respected, like the officer respects them, that can increase legitimacy and can increase accountability. But you need to give officers the training in that, and you also need to make sure that officers' supervisors have the tools they need to make sure officers are doing that out in the field.
Sam Beeler, you mentioned the Ferguson effect, and around here at Midday, we thought of that when we got to the paragraph in your series. Justin Fenton, you quoted an officer who compared 2015 to the baseball era of steroids. He said the stats of 2015, the crime stats, shouldn't count, or they should be marked with an asterisk somehow. And I was like, well, why would one not look at the crime stats of 2015 in Baltimore City and say that's what the picture was? Why would you somehow put an asterisk by it? And it made me wonder whether that officer, who was not named in your series, was essentially saying the same thing that we heard former Commissioner Anthony Batts say about 2 months after he was fired, when he said that he thought police officers in Baltimore took a knee, pulled back after the riots in April. How did you, Justin Fenton, how did you hear what that officer was saying in terms of this legitimacy and accountability trade-off?
Sure. I mean, in truthfulness, it was a comment made in jest. I think the officers were sitting around, and they were truly in awe of the rate at which cases were coming in. I mean, we have to remember that we averaged almost a homicide a day last year, but that didn't really begin until May. The post-April rate was far higher, and the cases were coming in at a rate that these detectives, who were younger detectives, had not seen before. So they were saying, you know, our rate is so low, my goodness, this shouldn't even count in the long term. I think that within the unit, though, in terms of more thoughtful commentary on what's happening, the detectives do feel as though the crime spike here was fueled in part by officers on the street who weren't working as hard. They weren't condoning it, but they were saying that they felt as though that did play a factor. Now, whether that was short term or whether it continues is really hard to size up, because, I mean, obviously, I think once that started to go around, I think officials and union leaders sort of distancing themselves from that. If you remember early on, a lot of the union leaders had said, yeah, like we're scared to do our jobs. And then there was sort of this backlash to, well, are you taking a knee and crime is going up? And they said, oh, no, we would never stop doing our job. So it remains sort of a difficult issue to wrap your arms around.
Sam Beeler, with the kind of research you do in looking at police departments in many cities, what goes through your mind when you hear Justin Fenton describe the painstaking difficulty that these two police detectives in Baltimore had investigating this particular crime, getting any kind of information from the citizenry?
You know, I think that it's really indicative of the challenge of investigating these very serious offenses and the need for us, one, to begin thinking about ways that we can increase that clearance rate, and two, to think about ways that we can make sure that fewer cases have to come to those detectives in the first place. Obviously, one of the big things that I think is essential going forward will be investing more resources in prevention, investing in programs like Ceasefire that work on activating the moral authority of the community, getting the community behind gun violence prevention, focused deterrence efforts that discourage people who might engage in violence from engaging in offenses. But then when those offenses occur, we need to think a lot more about how we can improve the ability of police to solve these cases. Because I think this really goes back to the legitimacy question. When you're in a community and there's heavy policing presence for things like low-level drug offenses, disorder offenses, but then homicides aren't being solved and aggravated assaults and shootings aren't being solved, you begin to feel this cognitive dissonance. You feel both over-policed for things that aren't as important to you, but really under-policed for things that matter. So obviously investing in prevention is really the first step in this. But then if prevention isn't enough, and there will always be a few homicides, thinking about how we can provide police with more resources and more effective tactics for clearing homicides. And again, I think legitimacy and accountability, building effective relationships with the community, is going to be a big part of that.
We need to take another short break here. That was Sam Beeler, research associate in the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington. Also with us is Justin Fenton, Baltimore Sun reporter, author of the investigative series Chasing a Killer. You can be part of the conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 if you have a question for either of our guests, or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to take a short break. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. Here in the studio with me is Justin Fenton, Baltimore Sun reporter, author of the investigative series Chasing a Killer, which the Sun ran, I guess it was just last week,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
An inside look, very much inside look at a Baltimore police homicide investigation. And also with us is Sam Beeler, research associate in the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, who looks at questions of how police operate and how they can operate more efficiently. And Sam Beeler, you talked about some of the things that some of the resources that can be helpful. You mentioned Ceasefire. Baltimore has a version of that operating in five neighborhoods now?
We have two different of these programs. There's Ceasefire and there's Safe Streets. The Safe Streets is one that involves ex-offenders to try to mediate disputes, and then Ceasefire is one that sort of identifies people that police believe are responsible for violence and sort of gives them this ultimatum of engage with these services we're offering or face federal or state prison time.
And I guess, Sam Beeler, I'm just left sort of thinking Baltimore's trying to do a lot of what you talk about, and we're still socked with 344 homicides and 640-some non-fatal shootings last year. And how do you get ahead of it? How can you put more resources into prevention when clearly, as Justin Series showed us, the resources to investigate and solve cases are stretched?
I think part of that has to be figuring out ways to better use the existing justice resources that we have. One of the things that you certainly see across states throughout America is that people are now beginning to reevaluate what the best use of justice system resources is. A lot of states have invested heavily in prisons and are now slowly realizing that what you really want to be doing is investing more in that community service side. And while Baltimore has these, if a program's to be effective, it needs time to operate, it needs time to get up to speed, and it needs to be able to weather these occasional spikes in violence. Because really, no matter how much investment you make in services, in prevention, occasionally there are going to be spikes in violence. And you've seen that in a few cities throughout the United States. You've seen that certainly down here in D.C., seen it in a few other cities, and you need to be willing to persist past those spikes and then really take a hard look at your justice system, engage in some strategic planning, and ask not just can we get more resources into the system, but how are we spending our existing resources, and could we spend them more intelligently?
Well, in terms of persisting past these spikes, I don't know that the police department has any choice. I mean, when there's a murder, they have to investigate. I get part of what I found myself feeling very naive as I read your five-part series, Justin, because I think probably at some level I thought when there's such an increase, it was like a 50% increase in homicides.
It ended up being almost 60, yeah.
In 2015 compared to 2014. Mm-hmm. And I guess I just thought somehow either the police would create new detectives or hire new detectives or bring detectives from someplace else, that there would be more manpower devoted to investigating. And that wasn't the case. You really showed us how these guys pulling all-nighters, I mean, just how physically demanding on them this pace is.
That's something I couldn't appreciate until I was there with them. I was wiped out after the first week.
Because you were there for all this.
Yeah, and that's what they do on a regular basis. I mean, after I went back to what I was doing at the paper, they that's kind of the way things go for them. You know, I get the sense from the police department that, and from city leadership, that almost there is this sense that what happened last year is so outside the norm that it is destined to calm down. I think they're trying not to completely reinvent the wheel and shake things up. Their big plan last year was this BFED partnership with federal authorities. A handful of federal agents were sort of injected into the police department to assist in investigations. You know, that may help on the fringes, but it is not some sort of wholesale change. It is ongoing, and I think that, you know, it is paying some dividends, but I mean, it has not been, I think with a program of that magnitude, the way they sold it, we haven't really heard of any BFED successes, and I think that's because they continue to try to chip away at the same problem, and it's persisting in spite of those extra resources. So I get the sense that they are hoping that things calm down, and I think that maybe, just maybe, this quiet start to the year could be a sign of that. But I mean, you know, the flip side is that I think police will tell you that the shootings portend more shootings, that people, when someone is shot and that leads to a retaliatory shooting, that creates a new set of beefs that play out over weeks and months and years. And so there is a fear that the big spike last year is only going to persist because of the sort of the ripple effects that it creates.
Well, and of course, the other element that came clear in some of the conversations that you quoted when they were interrogating potential witnesses or a suspect is that not only does the increase in shootings create cause for retaliation, but it also raises the risk of cooperating. Mm-hmm. I mean, several of the people that the detectives talked to explicitly said, "I can't tell you anything."
There was no one they brought in who was scared to be there. There was no one who sort of was, you know, they all sort of wanted to engage the detectives. I think they were curious to hear what the detectives had to say. And some of the things that were coming out of people's mouths were very, even though you hear these things about stop snitching and not wanting to cooperate with police, I mean, there was that one exchange with a witness who said, you know, this is never going to stop. It's been going on since the beginning of time. And when the detective appealed to him and said, you know, what do you think Kevin would want you to do? He said, Kevin is looking down from heaven and doesn't want me to say a word. And to hear that come out of somebody's mouth was, I think, it laid things out for me in a way that I hadn't sort of realized before.
There was also a kind of a stunning scene that you describe of the detectives talking to someone trying to get in touch with somebody else they think they need to talk to, and a 10-year-old boy or boy who seems about 10 comes up and tells that adult, don't be talking to the police about our business.
Yeah, there was a guy sitting on the porch who was sort of like, you know, he was sort of reluctantly going along with the conversation, and a young boy said, don't tell them our business. And I think the detectives, again, they see this. You know, they were explaining to me going to families' houses to tell them about the death of their loved one, and people saying, go away, there's nothing you can do for us, call us when you solve the case. And, you know, that's something that that frustrates them. But again, I think they understand it, and yet it's something they have to deal with and they have to overcome somehow.
Sam Beeler, you have given some thought to witness protection. That certainly was the risk of retaliation was something that showed up in Justin's series. What about witness protection? Could we be doing more than we are? Could we somehow break some of the cycle of silence through better protection of witnesses?
Part of it is certainly witness protection, but there's also, I think Justin did a really good job of describing this, there's also a cultural bias against involving police in these matters that really needs to be broken down in a way that isn't just a simple conversation about safety. It's also a conversation about how effective people believe the police will be. I think one of the things came out in Justin's series as well as in other works that have looked at this, like Jill Levy's Ghetto Side, is that a lot of people feel that retaliation, personal justice, is going to be more effective than the police in getting them justice for their friends and family that they've lost. And so I think that while witness protection can be a part of the solution, a lot more of what needs to be done is thinking about how you break down this cultural divide, how you encourage people to see the police as an effective method for resolving homicides and a method that's more effective than personal retaliation.
Justin, your Baltimore Sun colleague Meredith Cohn wrote a piece last month detailing that gunshot victims make up a larger share of the caseload in emergency rooms. Cohn wrote, quote, although the hospitals and staff are equipped to handle the increased volume, the emotional impact of such daily carnage is a different matter, close quote. From your time sort of embedded with the homicide unit, I mean, are they equipped to handle this? It didn't seem to me as much the emotional impact, although there was some of that, as just sheer out not enough numbers.
There was a sense that they were very focused on the task. They're very task driven and sort of disassociated from what was going on. You know, that may be a front. I did see some moments where detectives became very reflective. There was one case that came out in a different squad, so it didn't make my article, but it was a man who had been threatened. He had been told to get out of the area, and then he was killed, and the detective investigating the case came back from the scene, and she kind of stood there in a daze and was like, why wouldn't he have left if he knew that was coming? And so I think it has to take a toll, but at the same time, they really are so overworked, and they are so focused on the tasks that, you know, they did not let that show very often.
As you mentioned earlier, this case is still written in red on the list of cases. It's still an unsolved case. Is it still being actively worked?
It's being actively worked. Excuse me. They are doing some forensic work on the gun that continues. You know, one aspect that I touched on and has been talked about in recent years is the dynamic between the police department and the state's attorney's office. For decades, the police department made the decision when they thought a case was closed, they would bring the charges, and then the prosecutors would look at it. And if they didn't feel it was good enough, they would drop the case. And that there's a lot of tensions between the police department and state's attorneys over that. They would publicly fight, as I'm sure people remember. So under the administration of Greg Bernstein, they sort of took over the charging authority, and that's kind of a sore spot for police. Yeah,
we have to leave it there. I want to thank you both. Sam Beeler, Research Associate in the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C., and Justin Fenton, Baltimore Sun reporter who wrote the 5-part investigative series Chasing a Killer. We'll put a link to that on our website. Lunch for our midday guests was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. And finally, thanks to all of our listeners for being part of this show. Join us tomorrow at midday. We'll speak with Patrick Gutierrez, who's running in the Democratic primary for mayor of Baltimore. Right now, stay tuned for Here and Now. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope to see you tomorrow.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Connor Graham. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.